I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Tariq Mendia, a litigation partner at Wilkie Farr & Gallagher in New York and chair of the firm's litigation department. Tariq, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, David.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, your background, then derivative litigation in the Delaware Court of Chancery, especially Caremark claims and the effect of changes in the law around Section 220 on that litigation. And then two cases from earlier this year in Delaware, one involving poison pill at Williams, the other involving a insurgent at Cytodyn. And then finally, your interest in music and shortwave radio. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to practice at Wilkie and be a corporate litigator.
Hey, well, it's a sort of a long and tortured history. I grew up in Northern England in a small town called Bradford, just next to another fairly small town called Leeds. So grew up in Yorkshire, which had been frankly decimated by the Thatcher years in the 80s. So it was a sort of interesting childhood, and managed to, you know, get myself to a decent college, took my first law degree at Cambridge, and then came over to the US on what we call a Harkness Fellowship, which was essentially a reverse of the Rhodes scholarship. They gave it to, you know, 15 or 18 students from the Commonwealth, all over the Commonwealth, to come to the US and learn about the American education system, the American people, travel around the states. And I did that, and I sort of fell in love with the place, and it was very, very hard to go back. So I went to the U of Chicago Law School, where I focused on law and economics, ended up in New York as an associate at S&C, and then came over to Wilkie, goodness, 25 years ago or so, and I've been here ever since. I've had this love of M&A litigation from day one, and it's sort of an interesting area of the law, both because, or I certainly found it interesting because of the sort of interplay between corporate law, which I find, you know, fascinating, litigation, which I find exciting, and M&A litigation, unlike some of the other types of litigations that you can get involved in as a litigator at a big firm, is fairly contained. You don't have, you know, multi-year litigation where you can get a little bit soul-destroying, although I've done that too for many clients. But the good thing about M&A litigation, that it's fairly short-lived, you know, whether it's weeks or months, usually it's not years. And so I found that interesting and exciting. And also, David, I like the fact that you're in so many different industries, you know, whether it's the retail industry or the aerospace industry or the financial services industry. You get to learn a new industry every time you have a new case that keeps you active. So I showed up at Wilkie Farr, you know, 25 plus years ago, and been doing, you know, mainly M&A litigation, some securities litigation ever since. As you mentioned at the outset, I chaired the litigation department, and that's been growing in leaps and bounds over the last few years. We've now have offices on the West Coast in San Francisco and LA, where we have litigators. We've just opened a Chicago office, which is doing tremendously well. And we have our office here in New York and in DC. We have litigators in London, and that's expanding, and also in Paris. So the firm is on an upswing, certainly in litigation and in all other areas, given with the way the economy is booming. So look, it's an exciting time to be a lawyer at Wilkie Farr. It's certainly an exciting time to be a litigator, a corporate litigator at the firm.
One of the trends we've seen in Delaware in the last couple of years is the increase in derivative litigation, specifically Caremark claims that are much more likely to survive a motion to dismiss now than had been the case before 2019. So talk to us a little bit about Caremark, and maybe just a little bit about the doctrine, and then why we've seen this change and where the law is there now.
Yeah, look, it used to be, and this is such a cliche that we see in the cases, that the Caremark claims were supposed to be, you know, some of the most difficult claims for stockholders to survive a motion. And I think with the Bluebell case and several other cases, including a case that we handled for Clovis Oncology, I think that the judges decided that, yes, these claims are difficult to prove or to get a motion, But where you have a company that is focused on a particular industry or mission critical industry, and you can, you know, show with particularity that the board, you know, failed to monitor the compliance systems, or having put systems in place, ignored red flags, I'm now paraphrasing, that directors can be liable. And look, it's a high standard, but I think the judges in Delaware felt that perhaps the pendulum had swung too far in one direction. And so, you know, beginning with Bluebell and other cases such as Clovis, you know, the pendulum has begun to shift back some. It doesn't mean that every time something bad happens at a company that the directors are going to be held liable. So your run-of-the-mill securities cases where you have a stock drop and the company has to sell a securities class action, that should not, and I don't think the Delaware law has changed in this respect, that should not give rise to a Kmart claim. Look, things happen at companies. And the fact that the company sued and has to settle litigation for a variety of reasons, these corporate events happen. The question is where the conduct or the business of the company is very specific to an industry. And the board should have, you know, focused more on safety and compliance and or ignored red flags knowingly. And if the plaintiffs can show that through the discovery they get under Section 220, which really has expanded in leaps and bounds, and I'll get to that in a second, I think that the courts in Delaware have found that in those type of very specific cases that Caremark claims can survive. In the Clovis case, you know, it involved reporting results to the FDA. Ultimately, that case did survive a motion, and there was an internal or a special litigation committee that was adopted. And I think that case is still ongoing. The most recent manifestation of the Caremark claim, of course, as everybody knows, is the Boeing case, where Vice Chancellor Zirn was quite critical about the Boeing board of directors, both because they didn't really focus on safety, you know, despite the accidents involving the Boeing 737 MAX. That was I think in some ways a fairly easy case for Vice Chancellor Zirn to deny the motion to dismiss, because there was really no real evidence that the board focused on safety even after the first Boeing 737 crash. So in extreme cases like that, and I consider Boeing to be an extreme case, Caremark claims, I think, are going to survive. Those are going to be high-value cases. I don't think there has been a sea change in the Caremark law, David, but I do think in these very specific, extreme cases, you are going to see judges be far more focused on making sure that the stockholders do get their day in court, and that the cliche of days past where this was a very difficult case, or, you know, the most difficult case for a plaintiff to win, I think that is going to recede somewhat in these extreme high-value cases.
And you mentioned Section 220, which is the section of the Delaware Corporate Code that allows shareholders to seek corporate books and records for a proper purpose. Tell us about shareholder access under 220, how that law has evolved even over the last 10 years, and how that's affected not just Caremark litigation, but corporate litigation in the Delaware courts generally.
Yeah, look, the 220 used to be fairly narrowly circumscribed. I mean, when I was practicing 10, 15 years ago, you would get a 220 demand, and you could pretty much say that the demand had to be there with, you know, rifle shot precision. There had to be credible evidence of wrongdoing and vague requests for information that were broad discovery type requests without a supportable proper purpose rather than a conclusory proper purpose, where the scope of the documents didn't tie back to the purpose that you were expounding. There were so many ways that people would challenge those 220 requests.
Rifled precision was, in fact, a term that was used over and over in the case law. As you said, that was a very specific term that you would encounter when reading almost any 220 decision.
It's very true. Very true. And it was a phrase that we on the defense side love to use. That has changed, David. That's changed. There's no question that 220 is a much more favored device. And the way the courts have looked at it is, look, you get these derivative lawsuits and they're conclusory. So there were some cases that said these conclusory allegations in your derivative lawsuits really make no sense, and we're going to dismiss the case. Why don't you go and use the tools that you have? And if you can find evidence, particularized evidence that shows that maybe there is a claim here, go use the tools that Delaware law allows you to use. And so I think beginning with those lines of cases, you know, 220 became a much more of a powerful force in Delaware litigation. And now 220 demands are frankly customary in virtually, you know, any type of corporate trauma case and any type of a securities litigation of any materiality, you'll get derivative litigation and you will get 220 demands. And given the fairly low standard that you see in the case law that a plaintiff has to overcome in getting books and records of a company, there are very few cases, you know, that where the defense will take it the distance. There are some for sure, because there are standards. It's a fairly low standard, but there are standards. But if a plaintiff can show, you know, that a proper purpose to investigate credible basis for wrongdoing, and the plaintiff will get at a bare minimum books and records, basically board minutes, you know, board presentations and the like. Look, there are circumstances where a stockholder can get emails and other non sort of board type materials. And certainly where the business of the company is run, you know, through emails and other, you know, forms of electronic communication, it is really no defense to say that the stockholder is limited to, you know, certain types of documents. That area of law is evolving. It's very facts and circumstances specific, but there's no doubt that Section 220 law has expanded and stockholders are using the information and the tools that Delaware law provides them in formulating their derivative lawsuits. And you saw that used, frankly, to great effect in the Boeing litigation, where the 220 information was used effectively to show that certainly some of the board members were not as focused as they should have been on issues of safety and the like.
And in fact, one of the most striking documents quoted in that opinion is an email between directors. And that kind of communication, if you went back even 10 years ago, and certainly a generation ago, wouldn't have been captured electronically. It probably would have occurred over phone. By analogy, are Slack communications discoverable? It would seem that they would be. If email's discoverable, if text messages are discoverable, it would seem like Slack and other mediums like it would be discoverable.
I agree. I think it's going to be very difficult for people to say, look, the way that we are now communicating, given the way the world has evolved with people working from home, not being in the office, people on their phones, if you're using a Slack or you're using other forms of communication, I think it's only a matter of time before that gets litigated. And I'm not even sure that it would get litigated, because if there's evidence that people are using Slack to communicate, that ought to be captured. Certainly when I'm litigating, my philosophy is when I'm collecting documents, I do ask custodians or the company, what forms of communication do you use? And we need the whole gamut, whether it's, now I'm dating myself, you know, Messenger on the Microsoft network or chat function on Facebook, all of the other apps that we're seeing now, you need to give us those. And if you're using those routinely in communicating on about the subject matter of the litigation, then you need to turn off the auto-delete features that some of those apps provide. So yeah, look, it's a new world order. Things are changing, but I think the courts are keeping up with it. And I can't imagine that if people are using Slack to communicate, that those would not be discoverable. Just like, you know, text messages are discoverable, as you point out. They really doctrinally, logically should be no difference.
One of the most interesting cases we've seen this year from the Delaware Court of Chancery involved a poison pill at Williams Companies. Tell us a little bit about that case.
Yeah, that was a fascinating case, certainly for me, because I represented a third point in a case against Sotheby's where there was a two-tier pill. And in that case, you know, we deposed all of the directors on their understanding of a two-tier pill, where they had a different threshold for activist investors and another one for passive investors. So this one, the Williams pill, it was interesting to me because of a few things. First of all, the threshold was 5%, which obviously is a very low threshold. And I think that colors everything that we say or think about the Williams case, because it was something new. I mean, you see the 5% threshold, David, in NOL pills, but in a non-NOL setting to have a 5% threshold is pushing the envelope. And, you know, the Williams board decided they wanted to test that, and they did, you know, much to their dismay. The other interesting feature of the Williams pill that I thought was interesting was a fairly expansive view or definition of acting in concert. And look, we've all dealt with pills where it can be triggered by people acting in concert, but that's usually a fairly narrow definition of people acting in concert, and there's exceptions to proxy contests and the like. This one was a bit different and had what we call a daisy chain feature. It was designed, or certainly Vice Chancellor McCormick found that it was designed or would have the effect of chilling, communications between shareholders and bringing in shareholders that, maybe didn't have direct communications with each other. So it was a fairly expansive view of acting in concert, which I thought was interesting. That issue has been percolating with the practitioners for some time. Nobody wanted to be a test case, but this one obviously did become the test case. As I think most people will agree, when you're advising a board or a client, the first thing I say is, look, we can certainly push the envelope, but you don't want to be the test case. And you certainly don't want to be the test case where you have a 5% threshold and you have an expansive definition of acting in concert. And in this case, they had a fairly narrow definition of passive investor, which is another thing that Vice Chancellor McCormick found. So it was a pill that had some fairly interesting and unique features. That was one reason I found the case interesting. The other reason I think the case is interesting is because the threats that the pill was designed to address were sort of fairly general. There was no specific threat. So your normal case when somebody comes along and is making a hostile bid or is in the wings and you think there's a real threat of creeping control. Here, there were a series of threats that the board articulated. One was sort of stockholder activism generally, and the court, not surprisingly, found that that generalized threat, certainly under Delaware law, there are other states' laws that are different, but certainly under Delaware law, that was too general, too vague to constitute a threat under the UNICAL analysis. Related to that threat, David, was a threat that the board articulated in their litigation. They were concerned that there would be a bunch of short-term activism and that would distract management. And the court just sort of similarly found there that runs sort of counter to Delaware law that you can't take action just because your shareholders are going to act out of mistaken or ignorance belief in what's in the best interest of the corporation. So I think that the court found that those two were fairly controversial bases on which to adopt a pill, certainly a pill that had a 5% threshold and an expansive acting in concert provision. And the third threat, which was a cognizable threat under Delaware law, which is, hey, somebody's going to be rapidly acquiring more than 5% of our stock. We need to stop it. The court found, yeah, that is the type of legitimate threat that Delaware law recognizes. But the response that they had, the 5% threshold, the expansive AIC provision, was just not reasonable and proportionate to that threat. So it's a very interesting case. And the other reason I found the case fairly interesting is, and I had the same issue, frankly, in the Sotheby's case when I litigated that in 2014, the disconnect, David, between what the directors perceived to be the reason for the pill and the litigation posture in the briefs as to what the reasons were for the pill. There was a bunch of daylight between the contemporaneous record and the litigation record. And that's always a bit challenging to deal with in any court, but certainly in Delaware, where the courts really do focus on what was going through this director's mind. Why did the director do what they did? Is this credible? And look, in the Sotheby's case that we litigated, we found that the directors had a very superficial view and understanding of the way the pill worked and why the pill was adopted. And so one of the lessons I think I take away from the Williams case is, certainly as a defense lawyer, is when you are adopting a corporate reforms or you are engaging a board in taking action, just make sure that the board really understands why you are doing what you're doing and is able to articulate the basis for corporate action. And look, the poison pills can be a little bit complicated to understand, but I do think it's important. One lesson that I've taken away from Williams is take the time to make the clients understand why you are doing what you're doing, because ultimately that contemporaneous record is going to be the record you're going to have to defend at a deposition or, as in Williams, a trial. So it's a remarkable case. I really enjoyed following it. It did harken back to Third Point Sotheby's for me. And as we all know, the Chancery Court's opinion was affirmed summarily by the Delaware Supreme Court just a week or so ago.
And then Cytodyne, which Vice Chancellor Slights issued in October.
That's a very interesting case. That's gotten a lot of airplay too. So David, look, I, Wilkie, we do work on both sides. We do a lot of defense work. I enjoy that very much. We also do work for activists as well. So we have the unique experience here of doing litigation and corporate and proxy work for both sides of the aisle. So the CytoDyn case is a really interesting one because it is a case where the CytoDyn board rejected a nomination notice that was sent to the company well within the time frame. Well, let me rephrase that. It was sent on the eve of the deadline. So it was within the deadline, but there were a bunch of questions that the bylaws required a nomination notice to provide. For example, who is supporting the proxy contest and a bunch of other questions like that. And because the activist did not give the company time to look at these responses, get back to the activist with questions about the veracity of the answers that they had provided, by the time that the company had the chance to review all of the answers that were in the nomination notice, the deadline had long passed. And the company rejected the nomination notice and rejected the nominees on the grounds that the bylaws had not been complied with. It's important to note that the deadline was complied with. Most of the advance notice bylaw cases that are out there, you deal with deadlines. You miss a deadline by a day, you know, deadline's a deadline, and Delaware law respects those, and you are out of luck. This was not a deadline case. This is a case where Vice Chancellor Slides found that some of the answers were not accurate, that some of the interpretations of the questions that were answered were not reasonable. And so it's a bit more subjective. And Vice Chancellor Slides found that, I think it was a paper record, the company's response was reasonable under the bylaws. But, you know, bylaws are contract. The contract requires the shareholder to provide information. The information that was requested wasn't provided. And therefore, the board was well within its rights to reject the nomination. It's certainly not an unreasonable result. But what I think it will do or may do is create more litigation down the road, whether this case gets appealed or not. But I think what CytoDyn will do, I think, will trigger litigation over whether the company's response was reasonable, whether the interpretation of a bylaw or nomination requirement was reasonable. So I think there is more fodder for litigation. I did a case a few years ago, which was actually cited in CytoDyn, the Saba case, Saba v. BlackRock. And in that case, it's similar. We had a case where the board sent out a questionnaire to the activist, and the questionnaire was not filled out totally accurately, but perhaps more importantly, the questionnaire was returned later than the 5 business days that the bylaws required. Vice Chancellor Zurn did not allow the company to reject the nominees on that basis. And the Supreme Court of Delaware reversed Vice Chancellor Zurn and said, look, a deadline's a deadline, whether it's returning a questionnaire or whether it's getting in your notice by the advanced notice deadline, you know, you're on notice and there's no excuse not to get your information in. And the after-the-fact justifications for why you didn't comply with the bylaw are not going to cut it. That principle is fairly well established, and I think Vice Chancellor Slides was just adopting that baseline principle and expanding it somewhat in the context of you have to comply with these advance notice bylaws, even if it is a little bit more subjective than a hard and fast deadline. But I do think it's an interesting decision, and what's the takeaway? The takeaway for shareholders wanting to get representation on the board is that you read those bylaws carefully and answer the questions as best you can. Don't wait till the last minute and don't adopt unreasonable interpretations of the bylaws because you may be called out on it. And for the defense and the companies that are getting these answers, fly spec them carefully and make sure that the activist or the stockholder is being candid and is not taking an unreasonable interpretation of the bylaws, because if they are, you may have an opportunity to reject the nominees. So there's something in CytoDyn, I think, for everybody. The other thing I would finish with CytoDyn is, you know, the plaintiffs were trying to cloak themselves in Blasius, and the judge, I think, rightly found that in that situation that the Blasius standard is not applicable. You know, the bylaw is a contract. The court did cite Schnell, which is sort of an overarching principle that we're all aware of, which is just because you can do something doesn't mean you should, and you cannot do things that are inequitable, and that the bylaws are a contract together with the Schnell doctrine. The courts are going to have some real leeway in taking a hard look to see if the stockholder genuinely and reasonably complied with the bylaws and whether the board, in rejecting the nominees, genuinely and reasonably rejected them, or whether there was, you know, something inequitable at play. So It is an interesting decision, as I say. I think there's going to be more, or there could be more litigation, given the somewhat subjective nature of what we're dealing with, as opposed to a hard and fast deadline.
And then finally, your interests in music and shortwave radio.
Oh, those are, I mean, I love Delaware law, but those are my, those are true passions. Look, I've been a big music fan from childhood, and I love all sorts of music, but look, classical music has been a big part of my life, but both my kids are musicians. Running to Lincoln Center or Carnegie Hall, it's just a big part of our lives, and I'm so glad that the pandemic is virtually over and we can go back to concerts. But yeah, look, both my kids are violinists. My son plays more casually. My daughter is a serious violinist, and there's a lot of music in the house. We have a pretty huge vinyl collection. And look, we go to concerts all the time. Most of my spare time as a parent of young children growing up was running out on the road, attending concerts, attending recitals. And I'm just used to hearing scales being played from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And at some point, you know, you might hear a movement of a Bruch violin concerto, but most of the day is just spent listening to scales. And working from home, that can get a bit much, but I'm getting used to it. So that's our interest in music. And in terms of shortwave radio, it's interesting you bring that up. But that in some ways is one of the reasons I think I am here, coming from a small town in Northern England and running the litigation department at a big international law firm. The connection there is, as a kid growing up, I had this interest in listening to people, you know, all over the world on a shortwave radio. And that interest morphed into, you know, listening to people talk to each other on shortwave radio. And then as a teenager, I got my amateur radio license, and which meant I could speak to people all over the world with a small crystal oscillator and a piece of wire and a 12-volt battery and send Morse code to people on the other side of the planet. And it was a real sort of eye-opener. It was the magic of being able to communicate with somebody without wires and without, I guess, in those days, you know, fiber optics was not even something that we could even conceive of, and I couldn't conceive of. So that led to just this very strong interest in shortwave radio, high-frequency communications, and I still do it in my copious free time. I have an amateur radio station, and I have friends all over the world that I communicate with by voice and also by Morse code, which I think is the original instant messaging. Look, it's a great way of escaping. There's nothing better than after a long day of deposition work at the office that to come home and put your earphones on and listen to some distant crackly voice in Africa or Asia or Australia and talk to a stranger about the weather or the propagation or physics or electronics. And then that's it. And put them in a logbook, and you may talk to them again in a week. Or in some of my cases, you may not talk to that person again for another 15 years, and you'll talk to that person again, you know, 15 years later, and we'll talk about how life has changed. So it's a great little hobby. It's unfortunately, I think it's a dying hobby. We're trying to get more young people involved in it. I think I blackmailed my son to get his amateur radio license. And so he's also involved in it with me, but much, much less actively. But I love the hobby, and I still engage in it.
Tariq, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate it. And this was a lot of fun.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.